Well, let's talk about what's going on June 26th, the last roundup, right back home at the Opera House in Booth Bay Harbor.
Yeah, it's that show's been sold out for, I don't know, a couple of months or something like that. But when I decided last summer, I've been thinking about this for a while. And one of the things that I've always had in the back of my mind, you see it all the time. You see it a lot in sports, and you see it a lot in the entertainment business, where people just continue to be on stage or in the sports arena. You know, I always said Muhammad Ali was a huge idol of mine and someone I respected. And I always said, I don't want to be Muhammad Ali getting beat up by Leon Spinks. It's not a good look. So last summer, I've been doing 12 or 15 shows a year the last few years, and, you know, well-attended shows, a few of them sold out, everybody having a good time. And I said to myself, what's wrong with just saying my first comedy album was released 45 years ago? I was doing it for a decade before that. You know, what's wrong with saying I'm in my mid-70s and I've had a wonderful run and I'd like to retire while I could still remember all the words to my story? So, and I was doing an interview with Ray Ruth here at the Portland newspapers, and he said, so where's your last show? This was last summer. I said, well, it's over at the Colonial Theater in Laconia, New Hampshire. He says, what? And he said, you're kidding me. And I said, yeah, it's not a good look. So I called Kathy Sherrill down at the Opera House at Booth Bay Harbor, and I do show every summer in June, fourth Thursday in June usually. And we decided to do it. And that was a venue that I performed at, Rich, when I was probably 14 years old, 60 years ago, when I was in a high school rock and roll band. And I just thought and a lot of my material is about growing up in a small town on the coast of Maine, all this stuff. I said, that would be good. So that's it. I have a show 2 weeks from today on Friday the 20th. By the time this airs, that'll probably be already gone. That's at Vinegar Hill Music Theater in Arundel. And that's pretty well sold out. It'll be sold out by the time the doors open. But yeah, and what a wonderful life I've had. I've had a wonderful career and enjoyed every minute of it. And it's nice to be able to say thanks.
I think the first time I interviewed you, matter of fact, I know the first time I talked with you was after you had released I Just Kicked the Daylights Out of My CB Radio.
Okay, that goes back. That was 1978.
Yep.
And, you know, people forget, you know, I have a show in the at the Opera House at Booth Bay Harbor. There's a gallery space upstairs. And I've been illustrating books, calendars, greeting cards, and everything this whole time. You know, if you add up all the books that I've illustrated, it's well over a million books of copies sold of books that I've illustrated, but nobody thinks of me as an illustrator. And back in those days, that was before my first comedy album was released, and I had the Dubious Brothers. Right. And I've always been one of these people that I don't want to be the guy who thought about maybe I'd make a record. I want to make the record. I want to have the book out. I want to do the thing. I want to be on the TV show. And that was from Schooner Fair, the bass player,
yep.
Tom, and Chuck Romanoff, had a little record, a little recording studio in Auburn. And they had put out a couple of records, and I bumped into one of them. I bumped into Tom at a gig, and he said, well, we got a record company. I had written this song. And you know what was the big thrill, Rich, for me? So it's 1978. I'm 27 years old. And they put it on the jukebox at the Gateway Restaurant in Newport. I was living in Palmyra, and I walked into the restaurant, and somebody was playing my song, you know, that old song, Hey Mister, That's Me on the Jukebox.
Yeah.
So You know, that's the kind of thing that has happened to me over and over again, where I had an idea and I wanted to do something. And there's a lot of grace in this story, but people helped me and I was able to make the records and do the TV shows and do all this kind of stuff that was just, I was fascinated with that world from the time I was a little kid growing up in Booth Bay Harbor.
We're
You want
talking
to know
with,
the first time I was ever on the radio?
Yeah, please. We're talking with Tim Sample. Tell us about that. Yeah.
I think I was 9 years old, maybe, and that would have been 1960. And we used to listen to WBZ radio from Boston, Carl Vassouz, and all the, you know, all those disc jockeys on WBZ. And you could get skip distance, open AM radio, you could get it on the coast. And so they had a contest. So here I am, I'm 9 years old. I'm fascinated with listening to the radio and how it all works. And they had a contest, write a jingle for WBZ and call this, might even have been before they had 800 numbers, but call this number and sing your jingle into the phone, and they'll record it, and if they like it, they'll play it on WBZ, and they'll send you a Polaroid land camera. And son of a gun, I called up, I wrote a jingle, because I was always writing songs in my head, or just making up songs. I didn't know you can't, you know, I didn't play any instruments, I just made up songs. And I sang this jingle, and they played it on the air. And they call you up and say when they're going to play it. So I heard myself
Wow.
singing on WBZ when I was 9 years old. And I had already been on Ken McKenzie's show in Portland with the Cub Scouts, where you go on the show and, the, you know, and I thought, that's how you get on TV. That's how you get
Yeah.
on the radio.
Well, the people might not know you went to art school. You were playing music, playing in bands, and doing that before comedy. And am I right that it was Noel Paul Stuckey who said, you know, a lot of guys doing the music thing, but not many people can tell a story like you.
That, you know, that's an excellent overview, Rich, because so I met Noel Stuckey. I was 25 years old. I was a singer, songwriter, guitar player, playing acoustic guitar. I wasn't the best guitar player. I could sing. I could always sing well, but I wasn't the best guitar player. But I realized that if I could put together enough songs to do to play in a bar as a solo, I didn't have to act as an employment agency for a band and get all these guys who really didn't want to play music. They just wanted to meet girls and like that. So I was a solo artist, and it was at what is now Merrill Auditorium, and it was Portland City Hall Auditorium. And if you remember, the acoustics used to be terrible, and it had army green paint, and you know, it was a very different place. But I met Stuckey, and I was, of course, stunned, because, I mean, come on, Peter, Paul, and Mary, you got to be kidding me. And he could not have been nicer. I was 25, and he was 38 at that time. And we just hit it off. And he found out I was a cartoonist, and he was a cartoonist, and this, that, and the other thing. We started talking. And a year and a half later, I was living in his guest house in Blue Hill Falls, Maine, and he had renovated the hen house. Anyway, I played as an opening act for him on and off for a period of years. And then he started producing Dave Mallet.
Right.
And he produced Dave Mallet's first album. So this was long about 78 or 79. And Mallet and me and Stuckey and a couple other singer-songwriter guitar players, acoustic guitar playing Caucasian guys, right? Right in a row, one after the other. And it was at the Main State, what was then the Main State Theater at Lakewood, a very, very venerable venue. You know, it had, you know, all these famous movie stars.
Oh, yeah. Milton Berle, Tim Sample.
Yeah, all signed the guest room, the backstage. And we were rehearsing for a show. And Stuckey took me aside. He said, look, Tim, I you can do anything you want, but here's the deal. We have all these acoustic guitar playing singer-songwriters right in a row. And It's a bit much, but you have this other skill, like you say. You said you can tell a story, you can get people going. You can, maybe you ought to leave your guitar backstage and just go into. And naturally, I was, upset, and he doesn't like, he likes Dave Mallett better than he likes me, and all this other kind of stuff. But then I remember sitting by myself. He said, "You decide. Whatever way you go, it'd be fine. But I suggest this." And I realized I had seen these pictures of Peter, Paul, and Mary with the Beatles backstage at Royal Albert Hall and Ed Sullivan, and I thought maybe this guy knows something about the entertainment business, and I did. I went out and I did the show, and it went well. And but my favorite part of that whole story, I don't know if I ever mentioned this in an interview or anything, but there was a guy named Robert Newell who used to write
The Bangor Daily News critic, yes.
and he was notoriously hard on pop acts and pop singers. He liked classical music. He didn't think pop music was the thing. So he reviewed that show. And he panned the whole show. He said, "Ah, the Stookies, out of touch with everything else. I don't know who this guy Mallet is," but anyway, he didn't like any of it. But he said the worst part of the whole show was this guy Sample, who just kept coming out and running his mouth. But the best part was, he said, "I can't for the life of me understand why people were laughing at him." And I literally clipped that out and put that review inside my guitar case for a couple of years.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
How did you end up working with Marshall Dodge and Bob Bryan?
Well, that's a an it everything grew out of everything. So I knew Marshall, of course, everybody. Marshall was the main humorist. The Bert and I record that had come out in 1958 was the gold, and remains to this day, the gold standard of Downey's dialect recordings. So I knew who Marshall was, and I had actually met Marshall. And this is again, this is, where would I be without Noel Paul Stookey? Because I had met Marshall, and he actually asked me to be, 3 years before he and I started performing together, he asked me to be on the original board of the Maine Festival in Bowdoin College in 1977. And I did popular music and like that. So I knew him to say hello and, cordial, be cordial. And we chatted a few times about, things, but it was 1980 in December, and Stookey and I were working. We were always working on movie ideas for movie scripts. We never had any movies produced, but we had a lot of fun talking about stuff and met some interesting people doing it. But he said, I was living in Palmyra, Stookey was living in Blue Hill, and he said he was going down to do a show with Marshall in Portland. And Alan Karen, you remember Alan
Oh, I
Karen? He
do.
ran
Yeah.
for Governor Wells. Alan was producing the show for the Montjoy Hill Neighborhood Association or something. And Stookey said, "Well, just ride down with me and ride back with me and see the show. And we'll talk about our movie." And so we had dinner at the Hollow Reed. This all goes back. This is in the annals of time. And it's me and Stookey and Marshall and Alan Karen sitting around having dinner and talking about the show. And Alan looks, and Alan had no, by that time I was doing some storytelling and doing some dialect storytelling. And Alan looked at me and looked at Marshall and said, "Why don't you guys," it was a benefit, for this nonprofit, "why don't you guys get up and do a few minutes together?" And I looked at Marshall and he looked at me and we thought, what the heck, why not? We got up, Rich. And whatever chemistry it turned out we eventually had, we had a lot of onstage chemistry together because Marshall was like the straight man. And at the time, I didn't have any set material. I just rev up my mind and pop the clutch on my mouth. And Marshall was tired of doing the same exact stories over and over again. And here he would just wind me up, ask me silly questions, and get at it. Well, we hit, the crowd roared. And Marshall was going on, he had bought a thing that was available in those days called the Pan Am Anywhere Fare, where you could get on a Pan Am flight and start off, as long as you kept going in the same direction, you go all the way around the world. You paid one fare and you could go, you just keep going around the world. And he was going to New Zealand and Australia and all these places. But he said to me after this 10 minutes, 15 minutes on stage, he said, "Just book us some gigs." Well, because he was Marshall Dodge, I could do that and save this Marshall Dodge and this other guy. And he came back in May of 81, and we rehearsed a few things. I had booked us at the Chocolate Church, a theater at Monmouth, I don't know, just on Marshall's name. And you remember how that was. It was just amazing. We just hit like a bomb, and we were on all the, we were on all kind of newspapers and reviewed everywhere, sold out. I had never had that experience. And of course, everything was just ripping along, and we'd have Bill Cohen would come to our shows. We'd have all these, suddenly it was like a big jump up for me. And of course, you know what happened. And I was friends with Judd Strunk in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And Marshall had never met Judd. And I was up at the Six-Sided House up in Eustace, and I stayed up there one night and played guitars with Judd, and he said, what if you and Marshall and I did something together? I said, oh, that sounds great. So I went to Marshall. He said, that sounds great. And we had a show booked. I have the poster on my office wall. Oh. It's so poignant. And it says Sample and Dodge with special guest Judd Strunk. I think it's October 26th of 1981. And that was 2 weeks before that show was when Judd was and Dickie Iott were killed in that plane crash up in, you know, Carabasset Valley. Mm. And Dave Mallett came in and filled in, and we gave the proceeds to the Strunk family and all that. But that was October of 81, and it was January of 82 that I was in Florida on vacation. I got a call from Noel Stuckey. Nobody knew how to get in touch with me then, but Noel did, knew where I was staying or found out where I was staying. And he said, I want to be the first one. I don't want you to read this in the paper, but Marshall Dodge was just killed. I flew up. I drove up to Miami. I flew to New Haven for the funeral. And I had never met Bob Bryan until the funeral. And I, you know, it was such a bizarre thing, Rich, because I was arguably as close to Marshall as anybody during those recent months of touring and doing, you know, doing comedy together as a comedy duo on stage. There's a kind of chemistry. You really have to know the other person quite well. And we had that. And suddenly I'm at Yale University at this, you know, memorial service that Bobby was officiating at because he's an Episcopal priest. And no, everybody knew each other, except nobody knew me, and I didn't know anybody. And Bobby was so sweet. This is Bob Bryan in a nutshell. What a wonderful human being. He sought me out. He knew who I was. And he said, Tim, he came up and shook my hand. He said, Marshall told me all about you. He said, I've met the funniest guy in Maine and blah, 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 blah. And he said, this is devastating for all of us. But he gave me a business card. This is 1982. This is 43 years ago. And he said, when you feel like you get past this a little bit, come see me and we'll talk. And in the interim, I wrote this poem along the lines of Holman Day, those old doggerel poems that Holman Day did, you know, back around the turn of the 19th and 20th century, called The Junk of Marshall Dodge. And it got printed in the Waterville Sentinel or whatever. And I went down and I sat and talked with Bob Bryant. It had to be 3 or 4 hours. We just sat at the Burton Eye offices in Ipswich, Massachusetts, told stories. And one of my favorite lines from Bobby, I said, Bob, I have to tell you, I have a checkered past. I said, I've been thrown out of some of the best prep schools in New England. And Bobby laughed and said, Timmy, you give me 12 boys that was thrown out of the best prep schools in New England, and I could run the world.
I love it. What a great story.
So the first recording I did for the Burton Eye album was The Junk of Marshall Dodge, and it remains the only single ever released on the Burton Eye label. And then Bobby and I went to work and finished, recorded the album, which probably would have been an album that Marshall and I would have done, which was based on the How to Talk Yankee book. And it was like a Berlitz How to Learn a Foreign Language record. And here's a good story about How to Talk Yankee. So we pressed the album. In those days, you got a test pressing. It was to see if everything worked. And if you said, yep, it's okay, they pressed 1,000 records or whatever. And so we had a test pressing, and this was in the fall, maybe late summer, September maybe, of 1982. We had recorded How to Talk Yankee in Portland. And Bobby knew Leon Gorman. I became great friends with Leon later on. But I mean, all these people knew all these people. These are big names, you know. And Bobby said, well, we'll go up and see Leon. And then people have no idea that in 1982, there was one L.L. Bean Campbell.
Right.
One. Yep. And it came out for Christmas. And if your item was in the L.L. Bean catalog, Mr. Man, you sold some product. So we went up, we took our test pressing and a mock-up of the cover of the album. We sat in Leon's office in Freeport. All I remember, there was a potted palm and the plant pot was in the shape of a bean boot. And Bobby had brought a little record player and we put the record on and we played it for him and he laughed and he bought them. And I think, I'm not sure, in the few weeks around Christmas that year, we sold 10,000 of those. Of those albums. So what a charmed life. What a wonderful experience. Those are the things that I still, all these decades later, I go, did that really happen to me? What a fun that was.
We're talking with Tim Sample. And I felt this way about Marshall and his work and then in yours as well. And I'm not sure everybody always got this. Mainers were never the butt of the joke.
Oh, no.
They were in on it. The Mainers were in on it.
What happens with Maine humor, and you're right, people misunderstand. They think it's making fun of Mainers. And no, if you listen to these stories, what happens is there's this frisson, usually between the local and the people from away. And it's not mean-spirited at all. And it's not put down, but there's a dry philosophical edge. Does this road go all the way to Portland? Well, don't go nowhere. That's right there. You know, there's all this little, one of my favorite lines from one of my early albums was the tourist comes up, he's taking pictures of the farm up in Somerset County someplace, and he's all enthusiastic about nature and wildlife, and the farmer's just being a farmer, just trying to get his work done for the day. Then the photographer says, oh, he said, I'm fascinated. Some of these cows of yours have horns, and some of them don't have horns, and why is that? And the farmer puts down his rake. He says, that's a good question. He says, a lot of reasons that could be. He says, some of them are young. They ain't got the horns grown in. And other ones, we have to cut the horns off. They're saving up the barn. But if you're referring to that one right there, you was pointing at, he said, the reason that one ain't got no horns is that's a hoss. So it's always the Mainer that kind of comes out ahead. And I did a routine about 10 or 15 years ago. The center of my monologue was, I always talk about, you hear a lot about celebrating diversity, but Mainers have always celebrated adversity. And if you took out the mud season and the black flies and the obnoxious tourists and the bad weather, you'd have no Maine humor. It's this way of expressing tongue-in-cheek humor at getting by and getting through difficult things. And also, what I love about Maine humor and the Maine humor I grew up around and the people that would just tell stories, it's gentle. There's always a point, but you have to be able to see yourself in the picture. If you're really getting it, you're laughing at the human nature itself and the ironies, and everybody's a tourist somewhere, everybody's a native somewhere. It's just fascinating. But you can go back in history to the play, the farces of Shakespeare, and the elements are still funny in A Midsummer Night's Dream and Much Ado About Nothing. Why? Because the basic building blocks are human nature. And if human nature, everything can change, but human nature doesn't change. And I've always said, I've said this for years on stage, I've had it on recording, that you can be, Mainers have a reputation for being standoffish and cold and all this kind of stuff. But I said, no, you can come to Maine, you can be anybody you want to be, do anything you want to do, as long as you do not commit the cardinal sin. And then people say, what's the cardinal sin? And I say, it's somehow thinking that whoever you are, from wherever you are somehow better than the local people. If you think that, never mind, you don't have to say it. If you even think it, we're going to know. And you won't get 2 feet. But if you're willing to say, yeah, the way you do things around here, tell me a little bit more about that. And like that, that Mainers will give you the shirt off the back. But yeah, and one of the things that I've always laughed at, and I joke with Bob Marley sometimes, I guess, is that people will say that there was, I guess you'd call it birtherism. People will say, well, he's not really from Maine. That say that about me. And I'm thinking, well, first of all, I'm thinking, you know, how would I know this stuff if I wasn't from Maine? Would be one thing. But also, and Marley kind of, he agreed with this. If you get successful and you're from Maine, you can't really be from Maine and be successful.
Right,
you can't,
right.
You must be from away.
I'm going to give you the setup line, and you'll, I know you'll come in with what's next of, and I don't remember where I was. It was an outdoor show, though, and it remains to this day the loudest laugh I have ever heard in person. And the setup line, the setup was, how dare you do that before my wife?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If I'd have known it was her turn, I'd have let her go first.
It had to be about a 2-minute laugh. It was incredible.
Well, now I'll tell you a funny. So that's from the signature story on a Downey stand-up, which came out in 1983, the year after Marshall passed away, and after it was my first solo album for the Burt and I Company, and it was live at Lakewood Theater, and it was Maine Public Broadcasting that filmed it. And Gordon Wark, I could have killed him. Gordon was the producer on that, and when I came in after doing the monologue, he looked at me very sternly and he said, I have a big problem with your monologue. And I had just done this. It was a sold out show. And I just sank to, I said, what? He said, my sides are aching. But that was a punchline. And, you know, I owe so much to so many of the great storytellers. And Joe Parham was one of the greats. Joe was around. Kendall Morse was around, Marshall Dodge was around. There were a lot of great storytellers that were a generation or even two generations ahead of me. But Joe Parham would give me these punchlines. That's a punchline. And he would give me the punchline, and then he would say, you can do something with this. So the story, people don't necessarily know this, but the story Saturday night at Moody's Diner. So here I am, I'm at the theater at Lakewood, it's 1983, Marshall's been gone for over a year, and I'm thinking, who would want to come see me without Marshall Dodge? So it really, really, it hit me when it was a packed house. It was like you couldn't fit another person in there, and they clearly were there to hear me. And even then, I didn't have that much set material, but I would ad-lib stuff, and I had this punchline to the Saturday night at Moody's Diner story that Joe had given me. And what I did was, and I've used this technique, and I've talked to novelists and people who do graphic novels and regular novels, where you put the end line way out at the end and you wind your way to the story to hit that point. So I had the punchline, but I didn't have any other story. So I just started geographically. I picked out of thin air, I picked Moody's Diner. It was just it's an 8.5 minute ad lib is what it is on the record. And I just picked Moody's Diner because where we used to go when we went to basketball games in Booth Bay Harbor, we went to Damariscotta, or we went to Waldorf, we'd stop at Moody's Diner. And I just made the whole story up on the spot, and it became my signature story. And of course, you know, I had a lot of, I was at the Grand Auditorium, the Hancock County Auditorium in Ellsworth, and Russ Wiggins had just bought the Ellsworth American. And I wasn't at the Grand. I was at the Chamber of Commerce, in Ellsworth hired me to do the annual banquet or whatever the thing was. And of course, I had just recorded this album, And I couldn't get off stage without doing Saturday Night at Moody's Diner. It was like Spinal Tap. People were like, you have to do this. Well, I did the story, and most people are familiar with my work. I don't swear on stage. I don't drop F-bombs. I don't make fun of groups of people. But that story has the word fart in it. It does have the word fart. It does. And so the show went fine. Everybody loved it. A few days later, I was in Waterville at my office, and I got a call from, what was it, WDEA, the station in Ellsworth. And they called me up, and they said, Tim, do you have any response to Russ Wiggins' editorial in the Ellsworth American? I said, I didn't even know he wrote it. He said, well, it's all about you. And I said, oh, really? And they read it to me. And he had taken me to task for using that language in front of a mixed crowd. So, what was I going to do? Well, he was a very well-known and respected, journalist and everything else. So they said, we want you to give a statement for our 6 o'clock news or whatever. I said, I don't know. I said, here's the thing. Fax me the editorial so I can read it. And call me up in an hour. And if I can think of something appropriate to say, I'll say it and you can put it on the news. So they said, okay. And I read the editorial and he said he took offense. And so this is what I said. I said, now Russ Wiggins indicates that he has taken offense at a story I told the other night. And so all I can say to Mr. Wiggins is this. There are two aspects to offense. You can give it and you can take it. And I do the very best I can not to give it. And I'm afraid if he's going to take it, he has to do so on his own recognizance. Anyway, yeah, so much fun and so many, but the years just fly by, don't they?
They do. And I would be remiss if I didn't bring up, what was it, 11 years on CBS Sunday Morning sharing those postcards from Maine?
Oh, man. So it was 1993 in August, and I had just been on national television because I warmed up the crowd for Bill Clinton and George Mitchell were speaking. It was the election coming up, and they were speaking at Deering Oaks Park, and I warmed up the crowd for them and all that. So I've been all over the TV the week before, and I get this phone call. I was living in Bath. And the person that answered my phone in my office said, it's Charles Kuralt on the line for you. And I thought it was somebody like Chuck Kruger making up a funny voice. I know people who make funny voices, but it was Charles Kuralt. And he said, I'd like to interview you for this book that I'm writing about that involved some time in Maine. It was Charles Kuralt's America. And he said, I'd like to come visit you. And what am I going to say? Gee, I'm too busy. no. So anyway, and I had been a Kuralt fan since forever. As a matter of fact, I was traveling, I think, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan doing a one-night stand in Traverse City, Michigan. And I would do a show on Saturday night. I'd stay in a hotel. And Sunday morning, I'd wake up before I went to get my plane or whatever. And I flipped on the TV. I didn't watch a lot of TV, but I flipped on the TV Sunday morning. I was having a cup of coffee. And here comes Charles Kuralt out. And he says, we have a new show. And he's standing in front of the drawing table. And I remember saying to myself, whatever the hell this show is, it's Charles Kuralt. It's going to be great. So I was a fan of Sunday morning. I saw the first show. So fast forward to 1993. And Kuralt comes and he interviews me, and I'm just beside myself. I can't believe he's at my house. He's talking to me. And then after talking for a couple of hours, we stand out on the steps. I was living on Winter Street in Bath. I'll never forget it. He dug in his blue blazer and he dug out a Pall Mall and he lit it up and he said, I don't suppose you'd consider coming to work for me at CBS, no, John. And I said, I sure would. And they set a crew and I passed the audition. And for 11 years, I had it's like playing in the NBA. I had a wonderful producer, Mary Lou Teal, who just retired recently, but, a world-class producer working with world-class post-production. We would shoot 16 or 18 hours of film for a 6-minute piece. Wow. And the post-production was brilliant, and it was no expense spared. And it was the honor of my life to go and talk to the owner of the Camden Snowballer. And I interviewed Bob McCluskey. Robert McCluskey was an old friend of mine. I had narrated Burnt Out Deep Water Man for him back. We had become great friends. I had him on the show. Jamie Wyeth out on Monhegan Island. I went and interviewed Robert Indiana out on Vinyl Haven. I'm just pinching myself. And those are just the celebrities, but all the regular folks. We had so much fun. And to have that 2 to 4 million people every time we had a piece on. I had a friend who was living, he had a business in France, and he was flying back and forth. He just started this company in France, and he came in, he was jet lagged. He flipped on the TV in the hotel, and I was on there in Paris, France. He said, he called me up that day, said, "What the hell are you doing on TV in France?" I said, "It's CBS, wherever they got the TV on, if it's CBS, that's me." What a trip. And Charlie Osgood was just, because Carolt was only there for a year, and then he retired and he passed away less than a year after that. But Charlie Osgood was just great. I remember I was complaining about not getting paid in a timely manner because I was a regular correspondent, but I got paid per piece. And sometimes they'd owe me, $10,000 or $15,000. I'm sure for them, that wasn't very much. For me, it was quite a big chunk of change. And I asked Charlie Osgood, "How do I do this?" And he said, "Oh," and he took me down the street the next day and got me a big time agent to just negotiate my contract with CBS. And it's like things like that. Who gets to have that experience? I did.
Right. Here's what I need to know, Tim, though. How are we going to know what's going on with Hubert if you're not doing any more shows?
Well, that's a very good question. I've recorded, I think I figured out, I was just thinking about this when I was walking today, 9 solo albums and another several with other people or compilation albums. And there's, how many hours of material is that? It's a lot of hours, 10 or 12 hours of material. And I have these last 2 shows yet to do. And I'm really thinking about, our boy Hubert has to make an appearance. And here's a funny story about our boy Hubert. And for folks who aren't familiar with the Hubert character, I used to talk about our boy Hubert. You heard of folks who don't know nothing. Hubert don't even suspect nothing, He's in the gene pool, but it's definitely the shallow end. But the irony is people ask me where I got the, and this goes to the issue of making fun of people or not making fun of people. Where was the, Hubert is a type that exists in storytelling, rural storytelling. It's the sophomoric, it's the wise fool. It's like Gagnon, world champion, Moose Collaire, or like that. And what happens with characters like Hubert is they get the right answer, but they can't show you their work. They actually there's a weird logic. Like one of the most popular Hubert stories was Hubert Goes Cross Country. And in that story, Hubert is sitting in the trailer in Palmyra, and he wants to travel. He has an old car, but it has flat tires and a broken axle and all that, whatever. And he flips on the TV, and on the TV it says, if you join the AAA Motor Club and you pay your $30 or whatever, they're obligated to tow you up to 25 miles as often as you need it all year long. So he calls up, he joins, and they come with the tow truck and they drop him off. He goes around the corner and calls us, and I say, you can laugh, but he's doing pretty good. He sent a postcard from Oklahoma. So actually Hubert is me as a kid, the non-traditional problem solver. My backstory is like every successful comedian you ever heard in your life. We all have the learning disabilities, acting out, being class clown, socially awkward, not knowing what and was up, and then discovering the power of making people laugh and being able to be that person that brings laughter to a group of people. So Hubert is kind of a picture of me as a kid.
The final show, the Opera House in Booth Bay Harbor, it's sold out. If you don't have tickets, you'll have to hear about it from other people June 26th. But also, as you mentioned, the exhibit of your drawings and illustrations there at the Opera House through the end of the month, and also some of your recent pen and ink drawings on display throughout the summer at the main art gallery in Wiscasset.
Yeah, there are five pen and ink drawings at the art gallery in Wiscasset, and the show in Booth Bay Harbor, the art show, is open. It's available. You can go on their website, but between now and the end of the month of June. But what's interesting is people, as you say, don't know that I went to the what's now Mecca, Portland School of Art, back in the 60s, and I illustrated all these books. So what the oldest drawing in the show is from art school in 1970. Wow. And the newest one is from the current edition of Down East magazine, where they commissioned me to do an illustration about the story they have about me. So 1970, 2025, and in between there's greeting cards, calendar art, illustrations, the cover illustration for Saturday Night at Moody's Diner, preliminary drawings. It's a lot of fun to go look just to see that, like, you know, a whole bunch of 55 years of drawings as well.
Well, Tim, I know you're a humble guy, but you have amassed such a remarkable body of work through the years. I have enjoyed everything you've done. Well, going back to I just kicked the daylights out of my CB radio, have always enjoyed talking with you and seeing you perform. It's great to have a chance to put the wraps on it here, and wish you much good health and success going forward. And
thank you.
Have fun and with that final show.
I have to say, I feel like the luckiest man in the state of Maine. I had all this, so much potential and so many ideas that I wanted to express when I was just a kid. I wanted to be on television and radio and make records and do this and write books. And I've had the wonderful opportunity to, through many of the people we mentioned and many other people that didn't get mentioned, people were willing to give me a chance. And I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I got a chance to do that. And I've always tried to represent the state of Maine in a way that reflects just how complex and nuanced and beautiful and interesting the state of Maine really is.
Mission accomplished, my friend. Well done.
Thank you.